People here, and then we've got people from afar. And of all of you know that I want to welcome our provost, Tony Massey, and he's going to talk to us about the budget. And there are lots of people who are watching our streaming too, and they could ask questions from a distance. At the end of that, as usual, we'll have our normal updates on facilities, the feasibility project, and HR as time permits. But we'll first have a quick review of what our plans are for the open access mandate that's just come out from the tri-councils, and what some of our just introductory things that we're going to do in terms of education. So with that, and Tony's PowerPoint is ready, and we have some water for you. I am going to turn this over to you.
Okay. We need to have this on, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thanks a lot for giving me the opportunity to talk to the Dean's Corner about things. But I do this periodically. I come to faculty councils or the Dean's Corners or town halls. I give a presentation, and then I take questions. So I'll reverse it today. You can ask anything you want for the first couple of minutes. And if it covers the things that I would have talked about anyway, then that will save us time later on. But I'm sure you must have things on your mind that you'd like to ask, so ask. Yes?
Producer Crystal, I'll tell you about the financial situation of the university vis-a-vis funding from Quebec.
Well, Quebec funding has been going down. And I think all of you know that. Starting 4 years ago, there was a $19 million cut that persisted for 2 years in a row, never got reinstated. Last year, or the year we're living in now, there's a $20 million cut, came in two tranches in September and November. And next year, we've been promised, not threatened, a $6 million cut. So that means over a four-year period, we will have lost expected revenues of about $45 million from the government. Now, the government situation may improve. They're doing better than they thought. They might be able to balance their budget, and if they were able to do so, and then gearing up in the last half of a mandate, they might be able to provide some additional funding for universities. I'm not that optimistic about that, and it's not a crystal ball. It's just I don't think that, given the fact that Quebec has a 48% or so debt to GDP ratio, that it's capable of providing a lot more money to universities. I think we're into a regime where they will be comfortable continuing to shrink it. They've had two studies, one commissioned by the PQ, which was a chantier on the financing of universities by Tremblay-Roy, and another, that was a PQ study, another by the Liberals, by Robillard report. Both of them urged for the deregulation of international students, that Quebec should simply not provide subsidies any longer in any way, shape, or form, even with a forfaitaire. They should eliminate the using international students as a mechanism for any of their funding, and the universities that attract the students should pay the full price and keep the tuition. So that flexibility is actually quite good for a university like McGill, but it's clear that we won't have very many allies because it's bad for the universities that get subsidized from our students. So we don't know where that's going to go. But I think that it's flexibility rather than funding that will be the way of the future. Does that answer your question? Okay.
We can't see John. We can't see anything. That's all the symptoms have.
It's not online.
Well, I can't repeat that answer. I'm sorry. No way. Mark. No, we have it. Well, there are a few things about the change in the ministry, because it has a ripple effect. So the minister changed, and the person who became the minister was a former dean at Laval who ran unsuccessfully against the rector. So now he's kind of leapfrogged into being the rector's boss. So that might make it interesting in terms of his view. He has expressed some concerns about accessibility being tied directly to tuition rates, and that might have. But we no scenario that we have simulated assumes increases beyond slight indexation in the fees that Quebec students would pay. The ripple effect that we worry about is that the sous-ministre, who was unable to protect the minister from himself, that's not being recorded, from himself, she also left, and she was the one who was, got demoted a step, and she was the one who was looking after those two chantier and experiment and giving us access to more work groups. So the government under Bolduc and Lise Thibodeau, they set up six chantiers, six new working groups, and we're represented on five of them, that will look at university financing. It starts with the assessment of courses, because those of you who don't know about Quebec budgeting to universities, it's almost exclusively based on the number of courses that students take in different disciplines. So two students can be studying for the same degree, psychology, but if one is doing a BSc and the other is doing a BA, and their elective courses are in the respective faculties, science or arts, then we get different amounts of money for those students. So it's a cost factor weighted grid that we've been operating under. So the first chantier is to re-examine the assignment of courses to disciplines, and secondly, in the same chantier, to study the relative weight that those disciplines have. So right now, at McGill, if you have a class of 100 students in arts, it generates exactly the same revenue as 25 students studying agriculture. Right? So the weight's 4-1. So those relativities will also be studied. So that's the big chantier, the combination of how courses are put into disciplines and the relative weight of the disciplines. The second chantier that's very important for us is on the ways in which the government itself can express its priorities through the way in which it funds universities, so special research planning or special programs. They've done this in the past, and we have been beneficiaries of it in both management and engineering. But it's how they set those priorities that will be important, and how much of the envelope should be set aside. There's a chantier on small universities. There's another one on the general, the larger picture of policies, and our principal is serving on those. Is that right? So there's no hiring freeze on academic positions. That's been, McGill is based on having a strong academic component. We have tenure track positions. There are some casual, what are called contract academic staff positions, and of course, librarians are on either one of those. For the administrative and support staff, we are being cut in our budget because of the amount of money we spend compared to other universities on administrative and support staff. So they think we're overstaffed. And I say they think, but that has an impact, because they cut on those, they cut the amount from the budget. If we don't make commensurate cuts, then next year they'll cut us again on the same things. So there's an obligation that goes back to Bill 100 that said that we had to reduce by approximately 10% the number of people in. It's not. It'll take us until we get there. So right now, we did have a voluntary retirement plan that eliminated approximately 256 jobs. We needed to eliminate closer to 340 to kind of get to where we want. But in the meantime, a freeze is relative, right? It's not chiseled in stone, it's etched on ice, right? And today it'll still stick, but tomorrow, if it gets hot, we'll have to make some adjustments. There are positions you simply have to replace. So a freeze is always relative. It's never, you know, really chiseled there. So we have to see where, if a case can be made, it comes to a budget executive committee, which is the principal, myself, and VP DeGrappa, and we will look at all the requests that come in for replacements. But in general, attrition will still have to happen at McGill to get us in line. There's a penalty we pay for having, I hate to say this, but there's a penalty we pay for having generous students. Our students have levy fees on themselves that go to provide additional services. Those services come in the form of people, mostly, providing services. You provide those services for the fees that the students collect. The government looks at the disbursements, not where the money came from, and cuts us on that. But the only place they can cut is on the budget that they give us, not the budget that the students have provided for those services. So those services remain intact, and they can be replaced because they're not 1A funds, but the other services get cut even more. So the government, we're trying to convince them to look only at what they give us and not what we spend, because we have access to other sources of revenue, and they shouldn't penalize us for being able to do that. So it's going to last for a while. Yes. Right. So we took 150 accounts across the university that are common to all the big units, and we cut approximately 12% from all of those accounts. We then turned to the dean or the VP and said, we don't care if you cut in the place we cut, but we're suggesting you should look there first. The total parametric cut for every unit is between 2 and 3%. How it's implemented, I felt we couldn't make that determination. We could make a suggestion. Here's where we cut from. But we couldn't tell every unit that's where you should cut from. So we could have just as easily said, here's a 2% cut, deal with it. But we wanted to make some suggestions, but not written, again, not carved in stone. Chiseled in stone. No other questions? Yes? There are a couple of things about that question that are interesting and dangerous at the same time. We had a very long and sometimes bitter debate about the existence of two medical schools in the city of Montreal. It was called complementarity, right? The government framed it in terms of, well, we don't really need two children's hospitals. Maybe we can do with only one transplant unit. Maybe we can do something else. And that debate was quite bitter because a city of the size of Montreal could easily support two medical schools. It has a large enough hospital base to do it. And it wasn't so clear you were going to be able then to run the medical schools if you didn't have those aspects that were part of your teaching program. So complementarity can sound like a good idea because it could save resources. On the other hand, it could completely jeopardize the institutions. In fact, there was a feeling that it was jeopardizing the Montreal Children's Hospital at the expense of Saint-Justine or the transplant work at the Jewish General compared to other places. So we went through that, and there were some savings that can be accomplished by the sharing and by the elimination of useless duplication, but we shouldn't start with the assumption that everything is able to be shared equally and uniformly across the system. It's important not to have a lot of useless duplication, or any if you can avoid it, but I'm not sure it's that clear how you would do that without it jeopardizing the individual institutions and their ability to retain their autonomy. Sharing is a good thing. Interlibrary loan is a good thing, but not everything can be shared. Does that answer your question? Anything else? Height, weight, age? Okay. So if there are no other questions, let me quickly move into some things. First of all, there's been the library has significant achievements, and I think it's really important. that they be pointed out. We're aware of all the good things that you do here. I'm not going to talk about shortcomings yet. We're going to talk about only the good things. But there's a lot of things that I've continued to emphasize over the... For me now, coming to the end of my administrative career at McGill, for 15 years, libraries have reported to me. And I continue to think that we've made progress. I know some of you don't believe it, but I think we've made progress. But it is the librarian's job is the single fastest changing profession on our campus. And we just need to recognize that and work not only with the libraries, but with our faculty members and with the other deans to make sure that we continue to support libraries. We try to provide additional resources when the exchange rate becomes unwieldy. Last year, or 2 years ago, it was a good year. We didn't have to worry much because the dollar was almost at par, or was at par. This year, it's at 78 cents, and as we purchase things, those mean we've got 22% less spending power, so we have to provide additional resources to have that happen. The libraries have been managing themselves quite efficiently to bring new positions, and that is the academic positions, to bear on this enormous change that's taking place that has to do with not only electronic resources and how you access them, but also with our physical collections and how you use them. So our library spaces are really under a lot of pressure. I keep hearing keeping a book on the shelf in the McLennan Redpath Library costs $4.28. And if we instead had it in remote storage, it would cost less than 4 cents, and therefore... Whatever. I don't... The actual numbers, I'll leave to the experts. But what that means is we should rethink, and we have 60% or so of the volumes that haven't left the shelf in a decade. There's something that needs to be done to change the way we use the downtown, the core library spaces. It's changing the way in which students access materials, their expectations, so we have to really deal with that. And that's why we have to have this feasibility study to reimagine the physical complex and convert it to more creative purposes. It's really important that we have a modern library, and we want to improve accessibility for researchers and students, as well as reduce the draw on your time as staff members so you could provide the more modern services. So there are a lot of positive things going on in our libraries. We just reappointed the dean, so congratulations if you haven't already received them from your colleagues. And we're going to move forward with trying to achieve our strategic priorities. McGill is unique in Quebec, but not in Canada or in the context of large research-intensive universities, in having a provost. The provost position is a combination of the chief academic officer and the chief budget officer. And the reason you put those two things together is so that you can continue to lead with your academic priorities as you think about resource allocations. So that's a very common way of approaching budgeting at the major American Association of Universities, research-intensive universities, and pretty much in the U15 universities in Canada. So a provost is not unique in our peer group, but it is unique in Quebec. And I'm neither fish nor fowl with regard to committees that are set up in Quebec. The table of the Vice-Recteur des Affaires Académiques is really more like what my deputy provost does. And the table that deals with the Administration des Finances is Michael de Grappa's official title, but all of those people do the budget. And he doesn't, I do. So it's a combination that's not comfortable in this province. But we find it to be, I think over the last 10 years, we've solidified the notion that you lead with your academic priorities and therefore the provost should do the budget. It's also the fact that we want to do the budget in a multi-year way. We don't want to just do what the government asks us to do, which is present an annual budget. So we do a five-year projection. It's a rolling five-year average. And we also try to make sure that we're diversifying our revenue sources and we're making the budget increasingly more transparent. But the transparency of the budget from the office of the provost stops at the level of the dean or the VP. We don't try to manage to a specific unit, like how much should the McLennan Redpath compared to the Schulich Library have. That's a decision has to be made locally. The same is true. We don't tell the Dean of Arts how much should go to social work as compared to philosophy. Right? Those are local decisions. We try to deal with the bigger entities and let the units manage themselves. We've made some progress in embedding into the agreements that we make with deans and VPs these strategic priorities, and we've gotten new mechanisms, a new agreement process that is working relatively well. It still always needs improvement. You've already asked the question about administrative and support staff units. Deborah, it's a difficult situation. We continue to hire academics, but if we don't provide them with appropriate support, they're quickly going to get frustrated, and we won't be able to meet our academic mission. But we don't know what the right balance is. We do know that our ratios seem a bit higher than elsewhere, but as I said earlier, we have different sources of revenue that feed that. And it's certainly the case that we're not getting the support down to the level of departments where it could be most useful. So those are what are the indicators we would use? Against whom should we benchmark? Those are questions that we're addressing in a series of projects led by the VP Admin and Finance, including something called My Workplace. So trying to examine that. So what's the context of our budget? That was the original title of this. So this year, let me go back a year. When we ended fiscal year 2014, everybody was surprised that we actually ended it with a cash surplus. I had projected a $10 million cash deficit, right? So everybody thought I was chicken licking, right? You know, the sky is falling. But in the very last weeks of the last month of the last quarter of fiscal year 14, the government gave us $13 million more than we expected, and it was based on something called recomptage. They recalculated how much they owed us for the student courses that had been taken not only in T0, fiscal year 14, but T-1, T-2, and T-3. So all of a sudden, $13 million came rushing into our accounts, too late for us to do anything with, except apply it to the bottom line. So we would have had a $9 million deficit, so instead of 10, it would have been 9, but it turned out to be a plus 4. So that's the government changes its mind about what it's going to give you, when it's going to give it to you, and our auditors justly won't let us book something that the government says it's going to give us because they've cut us so often. So when it comes in, it looks like a windfall. We'd love it to be earlier so we could actually apply it to something useful. With such low interest rates, running a deficit is not a problem. It could be considered an investment. I think I use that line with the board. It sometimes works.
Okay.
Technical problem. We never have those, do we? Thank you. Okay. So now we're into this fiscal year, and we have projected a deficit of $7 million. Now, in the middle of the year, I pointed out, September and then November, we got $20 million cuts. I actually wasn't that worried when we got the $15 million cut in September. Because in the budget book, very clearly stated, you can read it, we said there's about $15 million worth of projects that we will spend the money on if and only if the government actually gives us the money. And we were going to wait until September or October to make a determination about allocating that money. In September, they announced $15 million cuts. I said, I don't have to worry about anything. We're covered. Except in November, they cut $5 million more. So then we announced those measures that were asked about earlier, hiring freeze, limits on spending for equipment, travel, entertainment. in order to try to reduce the possibility we'd have even bigger than a $7 million deficit. Now, when I announced those things, the amazing thing about McGill is that people here, even in crisis and when you've cut their budgets, they're savers, right? This is Scottish genes. They've managed to save an enormous amount of money, and so we're looking now and saying we're running about $1 million or $1.5 million better than the $7 million deficit. So we didn't spend the money. The $5 million has been saved through various savings, and we should end the year with about a five. So then here's the other swing: a $5 to $8 million deficit is within reason. Now, we're in a relatively solid position because we took seriously the $19 million cuts, and we're taking very seriously the $20 million cuts, and we really do believe that they will cut us at least $6 million next year. So that, but we took it seriously, and other universities are crying uncle, right? They're, oh my God, we can't possibly make it, and we haven't been out there yelling and screaming. In part because we've built a solid base, and we know that a cut is a cut, and we've budgeted accordingly. On the other hand, we don't want that to backfire on us, right? And say, oh, you've been so cautious, you don't need the money, you're rich, et cetera. No, we've been prudent, not rich. But this is what the deficits, this is what we thought we would get from the government way back in the budget book a year ago. And by December, this is what we then projected, and that's the difference. So this year, that $20 million less, but again, I had expenses, $15 million less than that. But next year, it's clearly $40 million. It could have been $45, but the government cuts, and then it indexes. So we're going to get a slight indexation in the grant, and there'll be a 2% indexation on Quebec tuition, and there's a 5% increase in deregulated tuition for students in engineering, science, management, and law. So this is the Quebec never reinvested. When we first did the budget book, there was supposed to be a reinvestment. It never materialized. Rather, we got a cut. And now we're looking at some improvement compared to the $45 million cut, a little bit, because of indexation. But that's all we can expect. But we have expenses that we have to honor. As we build the budget for fiscal year 16, we're honoring the salary commitments that we've made through MAUT to our academic staff, through the unions and the collective agreements that they have, to the M-level staff through their association's agreements. So all of those salary increases have been built into the budget I will be proposing to the board at the end of this month or beginning of next month. So, but just as a quick indicator, last year's salary policy cost us $17 million across all groups. This year's will cost $20 million. That's just to give salary increases. And yet the government is cutting its grant to us, so we have to have alternative sources of revenue in order to meet it, or we have to keep engaging in cuts. There's no other way to do it. There are also major lingering issues. First is pension liability. So everyone is going to say, oh, but the stock markets have done so well, the pension plan has got 12% returns, everything should be hunky-dory. Well, in fact, that's only the asset side. You have in your books, you have to have also your liabilities. And liabilities are going up in terms of the pension plan that we have at McGill. So that's one problem. Second, is pay equity. The pay equity payments that were made recently of almost $20 million, covering almost a 10-year period, really, we booked them. So that was accrued. It didn't affect our bottom line. But if there's a second round that's anywhere near that big, then that's going to have a major impact. And everyone knows pay equity is not the same as employment equity, right? So if two people are doing exactly the same job with exactly the same experience, they should be paid exactly the same, give or take a little bit. But pay equity deals with categories of employment. and you assign arbitrary value to those, and then you have to see who is being, which categories are being paid fairly, comparably, and then if they're below a certain threshold, everybody in the category has to be moved up, regardless of whether they're men or women. So the pay equity is different than employment equity, and it has many, many contradictory elements. We faced one, so think of it this way. Think only of those categories that are dominated by men. 60% of the people in the jobs are men. Then you try to plot it. It's called a regression line. You plot the best fit through the scatter of points. Then you take that regression line and you put it on the scatter of jobs that women have along the same dominated by women, 60% women. Forget about neutral jobs. And then you see how many of the positions of women would have to be moved up to be right on that predictive line. It's an interesting exercise, but it has enormous contradictions. One that's emerged at McGill is, I'm going to use an analogy, it's not really the one, but think of it this way. If you had cooks, chefs, and they're dominated by men, they wouldn't have to be moved anywhere, right? Their pay stays where it is. But if you had sous chefs and servers who were dominantly women, you'd have to move them up to the regression line. In both of those cases, moving them up to the regression line means they'll be paid more than your chefs. So now you've created an inequity in terms of what a collective agreement would want to see, which is, well, if I have a more qualified person, they should be, it's not equality of employment, it's equity across categories, but I've created an inequity, and there's no way to adjust that. Pay equity trumps collective agreements. So that means there's a lot of negotiation around pay equity. We need to reinvest heavily in our information technology. We need to invest in new spaces, including feasibility studies for the Royal Victoria Hospital, and we have to look at our deferred maintenance problem. In fact, in the next budget, we've set aside $11.5 million to just deal with deferred maintenance and some of our IT issues. And that's there. It's going to sound scary, right? But that $11.5 million is there for the next 40 years. So we think this probably should be 19. We're going to project in our five-year plan that the operating deficits will disappear by fiscal year 18 or 19. But we also have to pay down some of our accumulated deficit. We have an accumulated deficit at McGill now of just about $100 million. It's been varying about $100 million for the last 4 or 5 years. But we have to pay that down over some period, and that's roughly another $5 million through fiscal year 19. In order to do that, we have to cut from other areas, or we have to generate alternative revenues. Cuts are really difficult. We get used to doing things in a certain way. We don't want to question, you know, that's the way we do it. But we have to. We have to continually question ourselves, is this the best way to accomplish the tasks at hand? Second, are the tasks at hand the ones we really should be concentrating on? Or should we think about prioritizing them in a way that would eliminate certain things that we do? So we have to think that through carefully. Again, we're respecting salary policy. We're going to still do some academic renewal. We're going to pursue hiring plans, but less aggressively. And we have to get further reductions in admin and support staff, but only through attrition. We're not sending out massive announcements of position eliminations. Deferred maintenance has to be dealt with, and we also need to think about ways of investing in our infrastructure and innovations, even though we have a lean budget. Because if you stop innovating, you don't see your competition gets ahead of you. So honoring the commitments requires us to be prudent in other areas. We would have ended, if I just produced a budget with those commitments and we did nothing in terms of cuts, the 2 or 3% cuts, I would have to propose a budget to the Board of Governors that had a $30 to $32 million deficit. I mean, that's one-third of everything we have now after 200 years, right? It's hard to justify. and they wouldn't have let us do it. But they are letting us run a deficit of $14 million. So in fiscal year 16, I'm proposing to the Board of Governors that we be allowed to run a deficit of approximately 30 minus the 15 in cuts that we're taking, or close to $14 million. How do we grow our existing sources of revenue, and how do we generate new revenues? These are all issues I've taken up with the deans. They're very important ones for us, but we have to think them through. Strategic enrollment targets, changes in our own internal demography, new ways of thinking about our summer school and professional master's programs. These are ways we can generate, without changing who we are, we can generate additional revenues. I've continued to emphasize this every place I go. We have a good plan for McGill Innovative Learning Environments. It's in the strategic plan of the university. We've been pushing it. We're doing it with donors. We're also making adjustments internally where we can. But it starts right with you. It's reimagining the library. You know, how do we, if we're replacing physical volumes with digital sources, we're renovating our physical spaces, how do we do that in the best possible way? You start with the libraries because that's the place that's changing most rapidly. Second, our professors need to be trained on how to use the technology that students expect to find in their classrooms. We have to make the classrooms adaptable, but we have to have professors who are prepared. The other thing is change the classrooms and laboratory redesigns. If you haven't seen, or if you want to see a modern undergraduate wet lab, go to Otto Mass and take a look at the chemistry labs. They're absolutely spectacular. It's a really well-designed, modern approach, circular tables, not rectangular benches, information technology embedded into the furnishings and the walls. Access to chemicals through central rather than closets. It's just the way it should be. And we've been renovating spaces, classroom spaces, that are now, we're actually leaders, even though we don't have very much money. We've been leading both Canada and many North American universities in the implementation of smart classrooms. So you can take a look at those in Burnside Hall, in the Education Building, and several other places around campus. And finally, this is going to be MOOCs. I like to talk about those. Massively open online courses. When I presented the strategic plan of the university, I said we were interested in doing this. We then had an open session in Senate, and we talked about it. In between that Senate meeting and the next Senate meeting, I signed a contract with edX for McGill to join the partnership. The next Senate meeting, someone proposed a motion to censure me for having joined edX. That didn't go very far, but a few months later, the first MOOCs were launched, and our first one, Food for Thought, the Chemistry of Food, had about 30,000 students enrolled in 100 different countries around the world. And when that was announced at Senate, people cheered. So I thought that was a good combination. But we all said there was no revenue source that we could see that would happen. Last week, we got a small royalty check. A very small royalty check. Less than $3,000. And it cost $100,000 to design the course, right? So it's better than you would have gotten in the bank, right? 3%, come on. But it's one of those areas that we are learning really fast. The professors who've taught the MOOCs have brought back experiences in pedagogy that they can apply to their campus courses. So one of the best is the course on natural disasters, learned about peer-to-peer interactions on the massively open course and wondered if they could do it on campus. They flipped the classroom and they turned Leacock 132 for a period of time into poster sessions for research projects undertaken by a massive course of over 500 students. So an on-campus course. So they learned something, and these are prize-winning pedagogues on our campus. They're all won prizes for teaching, and they came back with something new. And I think that's why we got into MOOCs. We can learn something from the way in which they're designed, the way we design them, and they can have an impact on our residential course offerings. So it's a very positive experience. I don't expect that we're going to get any more royalties, but and we're not using a penny of public money. It's all donations. We've had $3 million of donations to help us move along this initiative. So we're already committed to student life and learning, research, and community engagement. We're fostering a new workplace, and we're transforming the physical environment. When Suzanne Fortier became the principal, she didn't ask us to undertake a whole new strategic plan. She said, the one you have is really good. She read it carefully, and she said, these are the five things embedded in it that I want you, the community, the VPs, the provost, the VPs, the deans, to work on. And they were providing a commitment about what's distinctive about getting an undergraduate degree at McGill. Research in terms of being curiosity-driven and creative, but also that would allow graduate students to learn about entrepreneurship and business. Most of our doctoral students don't go into academia. So what's their training to do something else when they finish if they haven't had a chance to learn about entrepreneurship or management? Better engagement with the community, and that could be partially related to the question about sharing and participating. Work culture is my workplace and the transformation of the physical and virtual campus. So I'll just finish with some current projects. On July 1st, Chris Manfredi, Dean of Arts, Professor of Political Science, becomes the next provost. But I have to do the budget before he gets there because the budget starts on May 1st and he doesn't start until July 1st. I said we renewed the dean of libraries, but we're also looking for a dean of agriculture, a dean of management, a dean of science, and a dean of graduate and postdoctoral studies. And they will all be filled before he becomes the provost. And we're looking, of course, for his successor in arts, but he'll have to undertake that search himself. At the end of the process, he is interviewing all the people who we're recommending could be dean, so he'll have at least a voice in the people who he'll have to work with for the next 5 years. You all know the difficulties of copyright compliance and the continuing saga of Copybeck suing Laval. But we think we're in good shape. Our work with edX continues. We're on both the high-level policy and logistics committee as well as on the research data committee of edX, and we're learning a lot. The transformation of MOOCs into SPOCs is taking a little longer, but that's massively open online courses as compared to small personalized online courses. Academic planning has to involve the future of the RVH and the Neurological Institute. We've got lots of fundraising initiatives. We've just changed the composition of Senate and making some recommendations about how to make it work better. I'm not going to make any comments. And we're updating our course evaluation policy, and we're actively engaged in data exchanges. So I'll end there and take any other questions if you have them. On the budget,
I have a question from afar.
Yeah.
Why do we continue to do multi-year budget projections when the university is continuing to fight cuts and forecast the budgets are always changing in light of new information and cuts?
Right. So one of the reasons you take on a multi-year budget, even in light of all of that uncertainty, is that salary commitments are multi-year. Hiring a person is multi-year. Investing in your infrastructure is often multi-year and phases into more than one budget year. So you need to do multi-year planning with the best available information. We generally come pretty close to estimating the revenues and the revenues and expenses in the university. We're better at the expenses, but because the revenues are dependent on the government. But if we didn't do multi-year planning, we wouldn't be able to tell people, here's a three-year plan for your salary increases. Here is the plan we can have for acquisitions in the library. We wouldn't be able to take on any multi-year arrangements. So you need to do a multi-year budget. Adjustments are made all the time. We never reissue a budget. At least we haven't in the last 10 years. Many other universities, because they're not as prudent in many ways, they think they're going to get a lot more and then the government makes a cut, they have to reissue a budget. We never have. Any other questions?
Since you foresee that the government will never return to better funding days and that you can just expect more cuts, even if you get a stable year of employment. What kind of thinking is the university doing in terms of finding new sources of important revenue to make us less dependent on it?
Right. So that's a really important question, and we have begun looking at it. One of the ways that we, without sacrificing who we are, we're a research-intensive, student-centered, publicly underfunded university, right? So how do we maintain that those mechanisms? One is we can use our strategic enrollment better. It's not to game the system, but we already have a large number of students in science and technology fields. Is there room to have even more? Because that does increase a revenue stream, and it's part of a mission of who we are. What if we were able to convince the government to deregulate art students the way they've deregulated science, management, engineering students? Well, that's between $11 and $17 million more a year in revenue for the university without us having to do anything differently. So it's gaining that flexibility. That's a big revenue source. That's why we're on the committees that the government has set up to look at the Clarter codes, to look at financing universities and the grid that's presently used. Second thing is that we certainly need to think about the internal structure of the university, both in terms of its size and its composition, and are we efficiently organized to deliver high-quality programs in every area of the university? That's a difficult question that we all the deans will have to be addressing. We also want to expand our fundraising. We only got to $100 million in a year once. Harvard last year raised $1.2 billion, right? 1 year. Stanford the year before, $1 billion, right? SickKids in Toronto had a billion-dollar campaign that lasted only 4 years. It took us nearly 9 years to raise our $1 billion. So you'd like to have $100 million a year steady coming in and less of it earmarked. It's very difficult to convince donors, but if they give you things for things that are good but you could use them in a slightly different way, you'd like to be convincing that that's a good thing to do. We don't offer, compared to the competition, very many professional master's programs. That's an area of growth, and it's also an area where technology can play a role in terms of your outreach. Another one is strategic international partnerships that we can develop that might bring us more students. We are very bad at our summer studies. I've noticed this for only 36 years, so maybe, but it's really bad. We teach courses that we already teach in the winter and the fall to our own students. It's not much of a summer school. The other thing is that we have some assets that we can sell that could generate money to help us renovate the buildings that we have. I mean, a lot of the row houses on Peel and Pine are really not that useful for academic purposes, and they would be better off in someone else's hands, not just because of the deferred maintenance costs. What? That's it. Yeah.
Increasing deregulation of various programs plus the increasing Quebec budget cuts is the first steps towards transitioning towards a more American public university funding model where there's single-digit percentages of budgets coming from the state.
So it's important to remember that those single-digit numbers coming to states at state universities is only on the operating side because they still have to get state appropriations for their capital projects. I think that it's going to be very hard to get to single digits from where we are, which is 45%. But in the United States, our competitors, the large AAU public universities that are research intensive, now get less than 10% of their operating budgets from their state governments. I mean, they used to call themselves state universities, then they were state-funded universities, then they were state-assisted universities. Now they just say they're state-located. Any other questions? If not, well, thank you very much for your attention.
Oh, thanks. also heard between those two, between state assisted and whatever state located, I've also heard state molested.
That would be the last category.
Yeah. Can I grab the...
Oh, yeah.
Sure. You could take a seat. We had, if anybody ever wonders how many people we have distant, we had about 50 people listening in to this right now. I want to take this opportunity to thank Tony for all, for during the time that I have been dean, when every single time, I didn't really need to go and say we need more money to keep us afloat with collections. And when I did, it was always there. And as all of you know, I just can't imagine what life would be like if we hadn't had that support. So I just want to say that. Thank you. So we're going to go on with the next part of for the rest of Dean's Corner, and I'm going to ask Jen.
Simple mechanical things. Let me see if I can figure this out. Okay. All right. Clip. One sec. I'm clipping this onto my pants. There we go. All right. Hopefully that doesn't go anywhere. Okay, so I am only going to speak very briefly today because we're going to have some sessions in the coming week that are going to follow up on this. But while we have everybody's attention, we just wanted to give you a little bit of background information on exactly what the new open access policy on publications from the tri-agencies is, and to give you just a hint of what in the library we can and will be doing to get us up to speed so that we can help our researchers with this issue. So basically, the new policy applies to peer-reviewed journal publications, not monographs, only peer-reviewed publications. This is part of their commitment to the peer review process as part of an important part of scholarship. Of those peer-reviewed publications, it's those that arise from grant from projects that they have funded. So these are research projects. They're not applied to, say, the fellowship grant programs. So it wouldn't apply to everything a graduate student writes who gets a fellowship funded. It just applies to the research programs from the three agencies. Awarded after May 1st, 2015, which is really soon, and which means it will affect some projects that have already been proposed, but that this program was not in place when those grant budgets were being developed, which might lead to some issues for some people. So we need to be ready for that. And the policy says that all of these peer-reviewed journal publications must be open, freely available to everyone on the web within 12 months of publication. So not immediately when it's released, but within 12 months. There's an allowable embargo period there. So how do you do this? The policy outlines two options. The first is to deposit your work in an open access repository. This could be a disciplinary repository like PubMed Central Canada, or it could be an institutional repository like eScholarship at McGill. Both are allowable. And again, that has to be done within 12 months. They encourage the deposit to be done sooner and an embargo to automatically turn on access after 12 months. Some repositories will do that, some won't. But it is the researcher's responsibility to make sure that happens. The other option is to publish in an open access journal. Sometimes these open access journals fund their activities through what are known as article processing charges. These are fees, usually between $1,500 and $3,000, charged to the author to cover the costs of publishing open access. Those article processing charges have always been and are continue to be explicitly allowable grant expenses. You can put a line item in your grant budget to cover these. There's also what we know as hybrid journals. So these are journals that have a subscription base, and you can pay an article processing charge on top of that to allow your particular article to be open access, even the whole journal is not. Those are also allowable under this policy. So what I anticipate is that we're going to get lots of questions here. And following up on Provost Massey's statement earlier that librarianship is the fastest changing profession on this campus, it's things like this that we need to dive into and get ready to deal with and train ourselves up and be there ready for our researchers. So I'm expecting questions like, so if I'm supposed to deposit this in a repository, but I get this author agreement that tells me I can't do that, what do I do? We need to be able to help. There are tools out there that we'll explain in other venues to you to help authors negotiate their rights with their publisher and help them comply with the policy. We need to be able to help them understand their publishing agreements. There's a lot of legalese in these documents, and there's ways and there's resources out there that make it simpler and easier for them to understand, and we can help. We need to help them find a place to deposit. Okay, if I'm going to deposit my article, where do I go? In some disciplines, this is easy. In the health and life sciences, PubMed Central Canada is the place to go. In other disciplines, it's not quite so clear. So there's ways that we can help researchers locate these repositories. There are big databases of repositories with thousands of entries in them that we can search, and we can learn about our different disciplines to know what the best places to deposit are. And we can, of course, offer our own institutional repository e-scholarship at McGill for this purpose. And alternatively, if they want to take the open access publishing route, what are the good journals to publish in open access? What are the notable, respected open access journals in your field? Again, our liaisons can be on the front of this, knowing what the best resources are and help people understand where the open access publishing options are. We have, as of yesterday, thanks to Ed Bilodeau and Rebecca, some new open access web pages on the library's website. They look very, very pretty. The two of them did a lot of work to get these things cleaned up and ready to go in short order. So we put some information online here that talks about, there's a page about how to comply with the open access policy and more general information about how to make your work open access, why you should do that, and what you can do to get help. And this is the library services that we'll be providing. So what we're envisioning is doing some workshops for faculty before this semester wraps up. So this is in the next few weeks because the clock is ticking. When I sent an email about the open access policy to all of you in the last couple days, I said we're going to need to mobilize some forces. We're going to need to get some volunteers from the library to work on giving these info sessions to faculty. I've already heard from three people, and through info sessions we're going to hold in the next week, I'm hoping to recruit some more, and we really appreciate those of you who are willing to step up and do this. We're going to take as many people as we can, and we're going to get out there to as many faculty as we can this semester. We'll do that process again over the summer and in the fall as people are starting to work on these grants that are affected by this. So, just to wrap up, oops, that's not the right window. In order to learn more, we're going to have some info session for you, the library staff. One of them is going to be tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. One of them is going to be next Wednesday in the afternoon following our morning symposium, faculty symposium. So I think that's the place where we're really going to delve into the nitty-gritty of exactly what's in this policy and exactly what all these places are that you can learn more. Please come to one of them if you're interested. This is where we're going to start the discussion, and this is where we're going to mobilize ourselves to do more. So I don't want to take too much time out of today to get into the details, because we're going to do that in these other forums. But if there are more general questions that is worth talking about today, let's have a quick conversation on that or answer questions.
I'm just wondering what our collaboration is with Teaching and Learning Services and our Office of Research. Faculty won't necessarily know that. They think, oh, I have a question about this.
Exactly. Yeah, I've been talking with the Office of Research, Research International Relations. They have somebody that's been working on the tri-agency policies with me for the last couple months. She was out last week when this all hit, so she and I are trying to touch base on this week while we're getting announcements out. They're going to be a key player in this because this is a funder compliance issue, and they care very, very deeply about that. The teaching and learning services is kind of the other side. You know, you have research and teaching and learning. We're going to see how much they want to be engaged in this and how much they think it's relevant to what they're working on.
But. How closely connected is this to the research, the positive research data?
Right. So, absolutely. So the tri-agencies have also been talking about policies related to the data that drives this research. They have chosen to treat these as slightly separate for now. This policy only applies to publications. They are discussing and expect to release a policy related to research data in the next year or so. The dates keep changing when we hear this. It's a little bit more tricky for data because it's a little bit more of a cultural change to share data. However, CIHR already has a policy
for sharing research data in certain disciplines, and that is not changing. And SHRC has a policy not for the sharing of research data, but for the archiving of research data. So those are still in play. What we expect from the future policy on research data from the tri-agencies is requiring a data management plan in which you articulate what of your data can be archived and saved, you know, according to privacy and license rules, and if it can be, where it's going to go. That's what we expect. Anyway, yes?
Central Canada has not been available since the summer. Have you heard any update on when and whether it will be available again?
I have not. I was looking into that today, and I have not heard. I'm sorry, the question, yes, the question was PubMed Central Canada has been down for a little while, a couple months now, and exactly how does that affect all of this? And, of course, that is an issue. And I was, as I said, I was just looking into that today, trying to figure out exactly what's going on. You know, there's PubMed Central, the flagship that I think is probably the best immediate solution, but it's something we need to talk about in the community. So, very good question. Anything else? Well, I hope to see many of you either tomorrow or next Wednesday, so thank you.
Thank you. That this is obviously one of the great issues of our times, and we're making suddenly things are really happening when people's money is invested in compliance, then things happen more rapidly, and we need to be ready for it. And I really this needs to be part of the can of every librarian. Really, it doesn't matter if you deal with users as 100% of your job, or you deal with users for 20% of your job. It is something that we all need in our portfolio, because there are going to be a lot of people out there, and there are going to be a lot of people who are worried, and it's up to us to have the answers and to put them in a place where they can calm down. Okay, so staying calm will be the most important thing. Zen. We're going to talk about facilities.
Good, thank you. Just very briefly, I wanted to give you an update on how we're tracking with the feasibility study. It's progressing extremely well with our Shepley Bullfinch and EKM architect group. I want to remind everybody that next week, March 18th in the morning, is the symposium, which is tied with our feasibility study to help educate our faculty and any other interested staff members of the community to come and learn about the role of the academic library in the 21st century. And I think there's much to learn from the colleagues and speakers that we're bringing in, so I encourage you to attend. I don't believe we're streaming that, are we?
Yes.
We're streaming.
Yes.
Great. So join us in person, join us remotely. The Shepley Bullfinch EKM team will be here for two more visits. We're narrowing down options and fleshing out eventually what those options are. It's still a work in progress, so feedback is still being sought and encouraged. So we expect they'll be here at the end of March and probably again in April. Good. Now, as far as ongoing projects, the only project that we have underway, which is really wrapping up now, is the curtain wall, which is the last step of the terrace. The walls are coming down. We will not open the fishbowl until the flooring is done and the seating is reinstalled. So we expect to have that ready by the end of March. It's really important we get it done by then, because April is such an extremely busy time. So that's how that's progressing, and we're very glad that the window is opened up to our second floor colleagues. And the only other very small project that's underway is adding more shelving and rare books. So with that, I will turn it over. Unless you have any questions, I'm happy to answer any questions near or far. Great. Thank you.
Good afternoon. So some of the news that I have today are I've already made the weekly update, so I have one scoopish kind of news, depending where you're located. So this fall, spring, and summer, we will be welcoming new staff. Collection Services will be welcoming Robin Demel, that you've seen in the month of February in the position of cataloger. Professor Massey, Jen, help is coming your way in the hiring of Alexandra Kahn for the head of Copyright Office. She will be joining us in the month of August. Joel Nuttenbluth left Digital Initiative, the unit under Jen, to join Music as a senior reference assistant cataloging position. And Document Delivery, ILL, with Valerie Maiman, welcome Patricia Nilsson in February. She was working in USO, so all internal movement in the admin and support side. With arrival comes departure. Valérie Fortin this winter announced that she wanted to dedicate her time to bigger and better things and has informed us that she would be retiring. She'll be with us until the end of May. So Valérie, thank you very much for this time with us, and we wish you all the best in this new chapter of your life. We saw also Dorothy Gowan leave us after 40-plus years here at McGill in the library. She worked in law, she worked in collection services. She left a big hole in collection services and will be missed. Collection Services, again, so another key employee announced that he would be leaving. He announced this week that it was time to leave the nest, leave home. Patrick Dupuis will be leaving ILL in the month of May. He has decided to pursue his career somewhere else. Current searches, we were busy in January and February with job talk. So we're closing and moving ahead with all those searches, and I would assume by the time that we have our new our next Dean's Corner, be able to announce who are the successful candidates in the searches for Data Reference Services Librarian, Coordinator, Data Creation, the Scholarly Communication Librarian position, the non-tenure track, two-year liaison librarian position in USO. And Rosa Pellucci was awarded a position in collection services as a specialized cataloging editor, has decided after a few months in the position to go back to her previous love with Louise Robertson in the collection services. So we'll have to somehow handle this search one more time. Upcoming posting, always the same list. I never seem to get a check on that list. So we have the director and university archivist. That's on top of my list. There's a financial administrator position in the dean's office, administrative assistant in the dean's office, programmer analyst within digital initiative, a senior library clerk position in Schulich, and a temporary position, another scoop, I guess. There's a need for an administrative support person for rare books and archives due to a sudden leave. So that's it for the HR update.
Yearbook in 1909. No. So, questions, general questions about anything? Anything from?
Nothing
more. Okay. Well, thank you all for coming and much appreciated. Have fun.
Bye.